ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, author John C. Payne joins us from San Antonio, Texas, where they're celebrating an NBA championship. Comedian Jan McGinnis has us laughing out loud, and New York Times bestseller Summer House with Swimming Pool, and our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know. And baby, ooh, I can feel it.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Well, I'm going to start off. I want to tell you guys a little bit of a story here about one of my favorite bands of all time, one of the most popular bands of all time, Queen. I absolutely love Queen.
I love their song Bohemian Rhapsody.
I love Bohemian Rhapsody too. And a very, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago, I'm sure you do, Adam Lambert, the contestant on American Idol, sung Bohemian Rhapsody and just knocked it out of the park. And at the end of that season, he actually was on stage with Queen performing. And apparently they liked it so much that they have just recently launched a tour together. Adam Lambert and Queen are working together. What was it, at the 2011 MTV Movie Awards? And they did a little brief thing in Europe, but now it's official. They started a 24-date North American run starting in Chicago.
You know, that's great, because you know what? I saw the one that was in Russia is where they did it.
Mm.
And they did the concert.
You saw it live?
I saw it streamed on Yahoo.
Yeah. That sounds and, like a bunch of...
No, they don't let me in Russia anymore. I don't know what the deal is. You know?
I have a few guesses, but I'll keep them to myself.
But this Adam Lambert, right? You know, I mean, you know the songs, right? But and he's got such a beautiful voice. I mean, he's really, you know, he's a showman too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And... So I saw him do, you know, they did Another One Bites the Dust, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they jazzed it up a little bit with the music. But this dude, Lambert, man, he came out and he just like totally changed that song around, made it his own, and it sounded phenomenal. I mean, and I was like, dang, this guy's really got it.
That does not surprise me. You know, I loved American Idol in the beginning. The first 5-6 seasons, I watched it religiously. And I'm not a huge music guy. Of course, I liked watching all the failures too, you know.
Especially
but
when Simon totally slammed
smacked somebody
him.
Down.
That was
exactly.
My favorite part. I loved Simon's honesty.
But by the time Lambert got there, I think it was like season 9 or something like that, it had really petered off. I was not watching it nearly as closely. And I remember watching that performance, and I basically said that to my wife. I said, that was probably the best performance I've ever seen on this stage. And this is a stage that produced Kelly Clarkson, mm-hmm. Carrie Underwood, you know, some decent singers in Ruben Studdard, Clay, you know what I'm saying? But yeah. It's like, I don't really care too much for Lambert that, like, as a contestant. Like, I wasn't really that invested. Mm-hmm. But, man, after that performance, he has really proven that he has – some singing chops.
I agree.
Yeah, not only is he doing this thing with Queen, which he's the perfect frontman for Queen. He just really
absolutely
is. His
perfect.
Look, his voice, everything.
Everything.
His two solo albums are really great. But the thing that's really kind of blows my mind is that, you know, he didn't win
No, amazing. He didn't even win.
He didn't win.
And it still was a great launching point for him.
He was the runner-up, and I was like, you know, how could he be the runner-up, man? There's nobody that could touch him.
Who
was
Carrie Underwood didn't win either. Oh, and really? Look at how many, she's won what, number of Grammys? You know, Kelly Clarkson, I think, is the only winner that's really gone on to real great success. It's been those hidden, like, fifth and sixth run contestants that have really come. The Tom Brady's, you know what I mean? Like, he was drafted in the sixth round, and he's gone on to win, you know, how many Super Bowls?
Well, when you think about the fact that what they go through to eliminate it down to those five, you know that those are going to be really talented.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, like, you choose one to be the winner, sure, but those, all of them are going to
get all that exposure, you know, during the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know what, Maya? It's like when you say who won, right? It's like, I don't know the guy's name. I can picture his
face.
Is
he famous?
Yeah. No, he's not.
Not really. Put out one album, because you always get a one album deal, and a lot of past winners have put out one album, had moderate, like, oh, yeah, that's great, and then just disappeared into the ether.
But the thing, you know, is that, you know, Queen is obviously, you know, one of the legendary rock acts, and Adam Lambert is a very good performer, you know?
And he has fun. I heard on that tour he also gets to wear all sorts of costumes.
Yeah,
you know,
he like
he's a total entertainer.
Eight different outfits, I think it was, when they did the Chicago show.
Yeah,
and you know, Freddie loved doing that, too, you know what I mean? Like, he was, the costume was part of it. You know, and I think there was a few things that really came out that come out of this is Adam Lambert is not Freddie Mercury. He's Adam Lambert. But Adam Lambert works very well with Queen, almost as well as Freddie Mercury worked with Queen. I think that's the number one takeaway. I think the second thing is this is going to be a good combination because Queen has a humongous catalog, a lot. And like stuff that was moderately popular, a lot of stuff that was big hits. But they're even getting standing ovations on the stuff that was, you know, like, okay. So I think this is going to be one of those, like the guy from the Joint Journey, you know, that Filipino guy.
Right,
that I think this is going to be that kind of a story. I mean, it's not like they discovered him out of nowhere, but it's going to be that thing where Adam Lambert was a good singer. He was well known, and now he's going to be a star.
Wow. Yeah, and you know what? I think it speaks a lot to Adam Lambert, too, because he was a star on his own.
Yeah.
You know, and when Queen approached him, he just did a couple of dates, like, you know, like he did the one in Russia, you know, and, you know, so, you know, for him to say, yeah, I'll do this, you know, that's really cool. And speaking of Russia, I think Maya's got a story on something that happened in Europe not too long ago.
Well, there are all these different mediums of ways to help people understand pieces of the past. And something that can be really effective in helping people see that is with theater. And so Anne Frank's diary has been brought to life in a big production going on in Amsterdam right now in theater. It's basically a chance to transport the viewers back in time to see what it was actually like for her and her family when they were hiding from the Nazis during the Second World War.
Yeah, because I heard they built like on the edge of Amsterdam, like they built almost like a little replica 1940s. Like what it would have been like in that era. So it's not just going to a theater in the modern era and trying to show you, but actually like immersing people.
It's like, totally. It's like you are in the apartment.
That's amazing.
And it has these interactive sets that it includes the apartment and there's a panoramic screen, and it really is, I think, a great way also of bringing it to a new generation.
Are there any Justin Bieber albums in there?
Better not be.
Oh, that'd be an interesting
Well, because remember, according to Bieber, if Anne were still alive today, she'd be a Belieber. He said that.
And when he made that comment, let's keep in mind he was 17 years old.
That's true. You know? And very wildly
and
successful.
And I would like to hear everybody's comments when they were 17.
Yeah. You don't want to hear mine, Charlie.
Yeah.
Luckily, there's not much. My life wasn't being documented every minute.
Yeah, that's true. These
that's another. Yeah, that's a whole
other
story.
I mean, you
story,
know, so. It's like he is the male diva, is he not?
Very true.
Another thing is that Anne's cousin, Buddy Ellis, which is her nearest surviving relative, is going to attend the opening, along with the Netherlands King, William Alexander.
Oh, the King of the Netherlands? That's great.
So it is quite a big production.
I would love to see it.
I would, too. What? I was actually in that play when I was in high school. And
you were?
Actually, just before high school, we did a production of it at a little independent theater in between, you know, near the little town where I grew up. I played Mr. Von Don, and it was probably one of my most moving theatrical experiences.
Wow. Right. Well, maybe you should travel to Amsterdam to see this.
I would love to.
You would have a true appreciation for it. And they are going to have headphone translations. I don't know if you speak the language there, but
is it being done in Dutch?
It is.
Oh, okay.
So in case you don't know Dutch, Jerry,
you can bring Bieber with you because he does speak Dutch.
Well, no, he speaks French. Might speak Dutch by now, but he does speak. Yeah, because he was raised. He's bilingual, trilingual, I guess.
He's trilingual.
He speaks Canadian too.
Well, he grew up. He was born and raised in Montreal.
Which is a
French-speaking
kid. Keeps coming back to Justin Bieber. Well,
no, see, he's trilingual because he speaks English, French, and Canadian. Okay, right? Yeah. You know, like, I'm sorry, eh? That's Canadian. So it's a whole other language.
And he does speak French, too. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And he can hip-hop. Yeah. And he speaks Spanish as well because he went out with Selena Gomez. So, you know.
Anne Frank, you know, I mean, it was an amazing movie, you know, a very touching story. You know, I think everybody can, you know, remembers it.
Yeah. You know, the thing I find most interesting about that is, you know, there have been a number of interpretations over the years. You know, there have been a couple of movies. I think at least twice it's been made into a movie. Of course, it's performed all over the world, you know, probably at any given time. There's a run of it going on. But I think this is, you know, to do the full immersion, doing it in Dutch, you know, showing that area, I think that this is going to have a huge... huge impact.
Definitely. Right. And the other thing is that the charity that owns the copyright to her diary has given the blessings that they can actually use Anne's own words.
Right on.
So some of the passages that are from, totally from the diary.
Yeah, because when I first heard about Anne Frank's story, it was required reading in school.
So. Yeah, same here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be good, a way to reach, you know, because sometimes history does seem kind of flat, you know, when you're reading about it, but to actually see it and to experience it, I think, you know, one of the biggest things about Anne Frank's story is, for me, is never again, you know, that I think people need to see this, and this is what happens. We cannot, you know, you can't go down that road again.
Because it really does personalize it. It's not just a historical thing, but this actually affected real people. The thing for me
about Anne Frank's story was it was so moving and touching, as Cyrus was talking about. But then when you find out what happened to her, she didn't make it.
No. Her father, I think, survived. And I think he ended up starting, because I think he was the one that, like, had the diary and released it. And the one thing I'm curious about is, you know, we, again, like Charlie said, you know, we grew up, it was required reading, but there's a lot of the diary that's not included, like, in the theatrical version, because it is the diary of a, you know, 12, 13 year old girl. So there's a lot of things, you know, parts of it have been, you know, chosen. I would be curious to see, if I can find a translated version, how much more new stuff, you know, that isn't part of the
unabridged.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How much of that stuff they included. Because
to make it personalized.
Yeah, if you were to do her whole diary, I mean, you're talking a 12-hour play probably. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested to see.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Anne Frank was no diva.
I love this story.
That's cool.
And there's a new book about divas on the late night talk show with Jay Leno. It's written by Dave Berg, and it's celeb dirt on the people that have come on the show before. And, you know, some of it is just hysterical. It's just, you know, hilarious and amazing. You're able to find this stuff out because, you know, you watch the show, you see Jay Leno, but you don't really know what goes on behind the scenes. There are two people tied as the biggest divas ever on the Tonight Show. One is Desperate Housewives star Terry Hatcher, and the other is Jessica Simpson.
Can I just say, when I heard you tell me that, I am amazed, because I don't really think of either of those people as gigantic stars.
I think maybe diva isn't the right word.
You think there's another word they want to use, but they couldn't?
Yeah, you know, maybe they were difficult.
Well, divas.
Well, you know what? And it's like, you know, when you look at the list of some of the people that are named in this book, you know, it's like, you know, Jessica Simpson, Eddie Murphy, Christian Bale, Jesse Jackson, Quentin Tarantino, which was a surprise to me.
Yeah,
me Bill too. Clinton,
really?
Howard Stern, Kobe Bryant, Dr. Phil, like Sharon, Clinton. And Ozzy Osbourne, and Dennis Rodman.
So I looked at that list, and a couple of those, I'm not surprised, a couple of them I am. But I got to know, what did Terry Hatcher and Jessica Simpson do to earn that, I guess, dubious honor?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing also to remember is that this isn't like a current list. You know, I mean, this goes all the way back to, you know, 1992.
Mm. So, before I was born.
Yeah, so a lot of these people, you know, that you just talked about, you know, they might not be big stars, you know, considered divas today, but, you know, back
know, at the time.
Yeah, 10 years ago, maybe, you know, they were more of a household name.
Well, yeah, Terry Hatcher was on Desperate Housewives, and at one point that was like the biggest show on earth.
Yeah.
What did she do?
You know, I've known people like this, maybe. But he said he had a nickname for her. He called her Terry 1 and Terry 2. Terry 1, he said, was a very charming, smart, witty, flirtatious. And then Terry 2 was like the moody, dark side. So she would call him up, you know, before her scheduled appearance and scream at him for not having, you know, better ideas, and then hang up all mad. And then she'd show up on the set, the studio the next day as if nothing had happened. You know, the smile on her face. I think
that's called bipolar disorder.
Yeah, exactly, right?
She's in denial of her own.
But then Jessica Simpson, I mean, she wasn't as bad as that. You know, she actually never appeared on the show.
Really?
Yeah, she asked for an $18,000 retainer, wanted this money up front for her hair and makeup.
Oh, wow.
You know, oh, baby.
What kind of makeup is she wearing? Like gold dust?
It must be something. So, you know, before she'd even go on the show. So they didn't know.
That's crazy.
She better not wash her face that night. I know, right?
Save it.
Okay. All right. So what about guys? Who's like the biggest guy diva? Because we don't usually think of guys as divas, but I know there's somebody asking for nothing but green M&Ms, right? Or something like that.
Exactly. And you hit the nail right on the head, Jerry. Eddie Murphy.
Why am I not surprised?
Has a sweet tooth, and when
I was just joking, really?
Yeah. A thing for M&Ms?
Exactly. Well, M&Ms, you know, Juicy Fruit, Milky Way, Snickers. He had to have all this stuff stocked in his green room to be on the show. 12 Snapples. I mean, you know, 12.
Who's going to drink 12 different, Snapples?
12 different flavors?
Well, fruit punch, orange, and grape.
You know? My God.
And then 8 Dr. Brown sodas, you know, and root beer and cream soda, you know, Coke in a glass bottle.
Kind of specific.
That is
very specific details, you know, and they had to be the exact number, you know, otherwise he'd be very upset. So
okay, now I'll share a story. I heard, and I don't remember what band it is, maybe it's Motley Crue. There was one band that said, like, they would always demand, like, M&Ms, but with one particular color.
It was Van Halen.
I think you told me that story. Yeah. And the reason for that was because they had these huge productions with, like, fireworks and pyrotechnics and that. And if the company that was setting them up didn't pay enough attention to the contract to do that particular thing, it would make them worried that maybe not all the safety features were in place, etc. So, but I can't see how Eddie Murphy having 12 Snapples and 8 Dr. Brown soda would be the same story.
What you're saying makes me think that maybe they had their own little drug and it was the color. Pills.
It was about
don't
safety.
Do red ones. The red ones are no, it's, special.
No, it's because if they didn't take the contract seriously enough to pay attention to those little details, then maybe they didn't take the safety equipment seriously. Maybe they didn't do all those sorts of things.
Gotcha.
So.
Yeah, it's called a rider in your contract.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, I think you were telling me that story. Yeah.
Were there other interesting ones too in that were reported for those backstage odd requests?
Well, there was one that was shocking, I guess. Howard Stern, he proved to everybody that he could never be trusted again. And actually,
what did he do?
No, not Howard.
Yeah, and got Jay Leno to leave the set. You know,
really?
Right.
Oh, I saw this one.
You saw it. Well, go ahead.
Okay,
and
what happened?
Tell us.
What Howard Stern did was he came on the show. He was very popular at the time. He had the number one book in America.
Right, Private Parts.
He had the number one movie.
And the number one radio show.
1995.
One radio show. And he came on the stage and he brought on these two strippers with him.
Really?
Right. And so, like, this is 95, right? You know, so keep the time frame in mind. And so he tells Jay, you know, he goes, hey, you know what, Jay? He goes, this is, you know, liberating times or whatever. And he goes, and, you know, you've never had a lesbian kiss on your show before.
Oh, my God.
You know, and he goes, and so Jay Leno goes, Howard, no. And he's just like, he goes, you know what? You got to do it, Jay. You got to grow up here. You got to, you know, he goes, and I brought these ladies right here. And he's like, you know, he's like, Howard, they're going to edit it out anyway. So he's like, well, but he went for it.
Wow.
And then he had the girls kiss. And then he's talked about this promotion that he does on his radio called Butt Bongo Fiesta, where he spanks girls, right?
Oh,
and then
God.
This girl could bend over his knee, and they were in bikinis, and he was giving her a spanking. And Jay Leno just like got, he was so mad.
He just left.
He's just like, I'm out of here, man.
That's for a different kind
and
of show.
And now you know why it's not shown live.
And then Quentin Tarantino, you talked about a little bit earlier. He got trashed. You know, they have the J Bar.
Oh yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, the mobile liquor studio
just got tanked. Yeah.
Really? So Tarantino?
Yeah, Tarantino.
Oh, wow.
So you know, those are just some of the highlights from this book that Dave Berg wrote. And you know, if you get a chance, check it out. Behind the Curtain.
I want to read it
now. Inside view of Jay Leno's Tonight Show, yeah.
You know, what's funny is when I just remembered something when you were talking about that, Bob Goldthwait, the comedian director, right. I remember he did something.
He set the set on fire.
He set it on fire. That's right, because he went on Mad TV like a year later, and he was joking about it, and he does a great Leno impersonation. And yeah, I guess he like turned around and like set the couch on fire or something.
He got fined for it afterwards.
Did he really?
Yeah,
and he had to do community service too.
Yeah, well, he was protesting the cancellation of the Arsenio Hall show. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
That was his reasoning behind it, yeah.
Guess he was never invited back for a return.
Yeah, I bet he wasn't.
Yeah, well, Jimmy Fallon's going to invite Bobcat.
Oh, really?
Bobcat Goldthwait on?
Yeah.
He's done a couple of movies recently. You know what?
Bobcat Goldthwait had an HBO special, right?
Okay.
That was just recently out.
Right.
And I love the title of it, man. It was like, because we remember him with his long hair.
Right.
You know, all crazy. Right?
Yep.
His special is called "You Don't Look Like That Anymore Either."
that is awesome. That is awesome. You know, Bobcat's really done a good. He's directed a couple of movies over the last 20 years. A couple of, I guess, cult hits, but some of my favorites. Shakes the Clown was a fantastic movie from the 90s. He wrote and directed it. I know he directed. He starred in it too. And he's one of those guys that has gone behind the scenes and quietly produced, you know, some quality work. Yeah, I like him as a comedian.
My biggest memory of him is always in the Police Academy.
Of course, and that's what most people remember. That was kind of at the height.
The thing is, you know, is that now he's, of course, much older. He's in his 50s, and he's bald, and he wears a cap, and he's very heavy, and he's like, yeah, you don't look like that anymore either. You know?
That's awesome. Yeah, when I was a kid, one of the few comedy albums I had on tape was his album Meet Bob, and it was M-E-A-T, and it was his favorite. Face in a pile of meat, like raw meat. It was like a meatloaf.
Jerry, you're really dating yourself.
I know. I'm old, man.
It was on tape?
It was on a cassette tape.
Yeah.
At least it was an 8-track.
You should sell it on eBay.
No, I don't still have it, but that was one of my favorites. Well, you know who made some good records over the years was Led Zeppelin.
They sure did.
They made some great records.
And they don't look like that anymore either.
They do not look like that anymore. Yeah. No. Well, you know, and a lot of people have asked, why don't we have a Zeppelin reunion?
Why don't we, Jerry?
I will tell you why. Well, I'll tell you part of the reason why. So Jimmy Page, in case you didn't hear, he had made some comments recently that he was fed up with Robert Plant essentially holding back a Led Zeppelin reunion. In fact, telling reporters at a press conference that he thought the guitarist, Plant, needed to have a good rest. So I think he needs to go to sleep and have a good rest and think again, Plant said. We have a great history together, and like all brothers, we have these moments where we don't speak on the same page, but that's life. So, you know, right now he's currently on the road with his band, the Inspirational Space Shifters. But they have talked about a Led Zeppelin reunion. They did that one concert in London in 2007, you know, and that was kind of, I think, the first time in 15, 20 years that they'd been on stage together. So essentially it's one of those situations where one wants to do it and the other one doesn't. And you kind of need both of them to participate.
Yeah. You know, the thing with Plant is, you know, he embraces his life, you know, and I saw a thing on 60 Minutes about him, and he's much older now. He's like in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still like a playful little boy. There was a woman that was interviewing him at his home when with his wife and his children and stuff like that. And he was just like flirting with her like crazy. And she was like, you know, you're going to have to settle down, Robert. You know, and he goes, oh, you can't talk to me like that. You know, I'll have to come over there and paddle you, which is really what she wants. You know, and his wife was just rolling her eyes, you know, because that's just him. And he continually goes out on tour with different people. Like
yeah.
He did that thing with Alison Krauss, won the Grammys for that.
Right.
And he does it stuff like that. Jimmy Page is like, you know, he's stuck in Zeppelin. He don't want to do anything but Led Zeppelin. And Robert Plant's like, dude,
I've moved on.
I'm done with it. You know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you know, it reminds me a lot of the talk surrounding the Beatles, you know, in that period after they broke up, but before Lennon was killed, you know, where everybody's like, why don't the Beatles get back together? And Lennon was that way. It's like, you know, I've moved on. He's doing all of these other things, and that's what Robert Plant is. But like you said, Jimmy Page is like, it's a one-track record, essentially. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? And that track is Zeppelin. It makes me wonder, it's like, is it, he doesn't have anything else to do, or he doesn't want to do anything else?
I think it's that he doesn't want to do anything
else. I think so, too. Because they were, you know, it was a magical time. It was a magical slice of, you know, a time. And I think that he just doesn't want it to end.
It makes me wonder, how long has Queen been going? Queen? Like we were talking about them. They go way back, right?
They go way back. They go back to like 73.
I was thinking 71.
They're still going.
Right. And Freddie died in 90.
He died in 1994. And he was 45 years old when he died.
Was it 94, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was still in school. Okay, yeah.
And he was the oldest member of the band.
That's true. Hmm. Well, you know, Brian just graduated from college again not too long ago. He has a PhD in astrophysics.
Yeah, he's an astrophysicist. Yep.
He teaches, I think, at either Cambridge or London, one of the universities in the UK. He teaches astrophysics when he's not playing awesome music.
Yeah, another band, too, from the era, The Doors, you know. Unlike the rest of these bands, they actually had a huge lawsuit that John Densmore has now, you know, wrote a book on and this huge world book tour. So, you know, I guess that's where their reunions are at these days.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like that. And that just goes to show, you know, sometimes these things don't always end well. I'd like to hear about some music that's happy.
Well, something that is definitely worth watching and listening to these days, Lana Del Rey.
Love it.
She's great. Yeah. She has been around since 2011. And she actually, when she came onto the scene, her real name she was using in the beginning, Elizabeth Grant.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it didn't quite work out. And so she kind of redefined her whole image and her personality. And she named herself Lana Del Rey. And she kind of hearkened back to that classic Hollywood look. Mm-hmm. And she has a new video out called Shades of Cool, and because her third studio album, Ultra Violence, it came out just recently, and it's a really interesting video because she is basically flirting with a man who's old enough to be her father. He is Mark Mahoney, who is a Hollywood tattoo artist, and he was actually in another one of her videos, West Coast. But it's really cool because she's like dancing in these dresses and she's wandering through these LA neighborhoods and she's eating a strawberry and in a pool. It's a cool video.
Yeah. And it's like a really, it's a great song.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be playing it on this segment. So you'll get a chance to hear some of that. And the thing about the old man, right, is like I thought the first two, right, she was flirting with an older man.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I saw an interview with her and she goes, no, people always miss the point. She goes, the point is that the old man is mourning for his loss of his wife. And he keeps remembering her as a younger woman when they were married, as a young woman.
That's interesting.
But he keeps, you know, seeing the video, he'll look away and he'll see her driving in the car or he'll see her dancing around or swimming in the pool. And that's the whole essence of the video.
So people probably misunderstand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was interesting because she has been stirring up a little controversy here and there. Something that happened is that Frances Bean Cobain.
Kurt Cobain's daughter.
Exactly.
Courtney Love.
There was kind of a Twitter little feud going on.
Really?
Momentarily. Because basically, Lana said to the British paper, The Guardian, they quoted her as saying, I wish I was dead already. And so it was actually taken out of context. And Frances was triggered by that since her own dad
committed suicide.
So she kind of lashed out on Twitter at her. And they ended up totally repairing it because Lana Del Rey explained the context of it. But
right. That's the problem when you take stuff out of context.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because she had a very, I guess, rocky start to her career. I remember reading this quote. She was on, I don't know if you remember, Saturday Night Live in 2012.
Bombed.
Yeah, and Brian Williams, the newscaster, said it was probably one of the worst outings in SNL history. Wow. You know, that's hard
to come
back
from. I watched a
video
of it to get the reminder. It just was not good
at all. Sinead O'Connor was huge. that she goes on SNL, tears up a picture of the Pope, career's in the toilet. You know what I mean? It's like SNL, like, is one of those few shows that can make you or break you. You have a bad showing there.
Well, that's the great thing. Lana Del Rey came back from it. One thing that was going on for her is that she went through a period of major drinking. And so she is now in recovery. And I think that was part of it.
Oh, that probably
is that she was in a different zone at that point. And she has really turned that around. And look, with this new, you know, the new album, it's really happening.
I've heard the whole album and it's, you know, Shades of Cool. I love that song. And but the whole album is really, really good.
Yeah, I think she's really a talented artist.
Yeah, I'm glad that she's in recovery because, you know, it's really easy. Like one of the people that was in the 27 Club is Amy Winehouse, and that's how she died.
Yep.
And there's lots of video of her going on stage where she was just like, you're like, what's
Blotto,
going on?
Blotto, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's good. You know, some of them take off like a rocket. Some have a rocky start, but it's really great to see somebody hit their stride like this. You know what I mean? Third album, she's got her stuff together. Yeah, I really wish Amy Winehouse had been that way because I loved her music. I loved her. I mean, just everything about her. It was just I'm glad to see Lana not go down that road.
Yeah. Well, and our show kind of is tied in with Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, it is.
Our first episode. It was right after she passed away.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. We played her music and all that. And yeah, I mean, she was a great talent. And
yeah. Not only did she have a great voice, she was a great writer. She wrote her own.
Yeah. She was very talented.
Yeah. Amazing.
Top to bottom.
Yeah. Something that's interesting is that I know that Lana performed for the couple, Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, at their wedding party. Not their actual wedding, but the party
at the Versailles when he rented it out.
Right? Yeah. And when Kanye had proposed to Kim, he had an orchestra play her song Young and Beautiful.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
Yeah, they're obviously big fans.
Obviously, yeah. Considering, you know, with their buying power, they could get pretty much anyone they want.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, you know, that Kanye West, man, he's pretty much all over the place. He can get whatever he wants, but he's no Charles Barkley, man.
That's right. I knew Charles Barkley, sir, and he is no Charles Barkley.
He is no Charles Barkley. Well, Charles Barkley on TNT's Inside the NBA, he really demonstrates what makes successful television and radio nowadays, and it's chemistry, you know, with Ernie Johnson, you know, the self-aware, straight talking token white guy, you know, and they got Kenny Smith the Jet, you know, Shaquille O'Neal, you know, they can sit around a table and they can joke around, you get that sense that they enjoy being together, you know, and joking around, and
it's not terrible.
Yeah. But you know what, Cyrus? I think it is about chemistry because it's just like our show. You know,
exactly.
You can tell that we're enjoying it.
Yeah.
And when you watch Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal and the rest of that crew, you could tell that they're really having fun too.
Yeah.
You know?
You
feel like you want to be there, or you are there.
Yeah. And you know, Barkley is just that way. I followed him on the golf course a couple of times over the years up in Portland. I've actually, you know, because like when you go to a golf tournament, you could like, you stay at one hole or you can follow golfers. Uh-huh. And I love Charles. And I've actually followed him around a couple of times during tournaments.
Oh,
and he's just always like that. Like he gets the joke. That's it. Whatever the joke is, Charles Barkley gets it at all times. And he's a lot of fun to be around.
Well, tell us about some of the stuff he's done with Shaq.
Well, you know, like on the Inside the NBA, they were in San Antonio. And, you know, they make jokes a lot, you know, like gone fishing, and they put like, you know, fishing caps on people and stuff like that. And Barkley had said something about women in San Antonio being, you know, a little overweight or something. And so they got a picture of this woman outside the stadium of San Antonio, and his shirt said, you know, Barkley don't know. And Barkley's response was, "That woman ain't from here. They flew her in from Dallas." So, you know, and here we are, we're laughing about it. You know, when they were on the set doing the Inside the NBA, they were just rolling over, you know, with that little monologue there, you know. So, and that's what's making successful TV. It's become a trend. Producers and people in the business are trying to, like, bring that into their shows, you know, and can look at other successes like Conan O'Brien and Andy Richter,
yeah,
you know, Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon.
Those guys are great together.
Oh, yeah.
That's fun.
And if you look at that, is a trend, and you know, NBC is in the driver's seat. We just talked about two people that are on Saturday Night Live, and Saturday Night Live is almost like a college, you know, where they just keep bringing in people. This
college
talent
to the pros, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they bring them in, they're on Saturday Night Live, you know, everyone gets to know them, and then they spin off. And it used to be they'd spin off to like a successful movie, but now they're spinning off into TV shows and like working with each other and bringing what we were just talking about, chemistry, to the network, you know, between the shows, between the actors, you know, they all know each other and they enjoy working.
Yeah, because like Seth Meyers took over Jimmy's old spot, right? Didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a really good point. I never thought about that. That, you know, because like in my era of SNL, the late 80s and 90s, you did SNL for 4 or 5 years and then you had a movie career. Mike Myers, John Lovitz, that kind of. And now I look at that group from the aughts and above. Yeah, Eddie Murphy, exactly. But these guys from the late 90s into the mid 2000s, they're all, Tina Fey, you know, continued on success in TV. Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers, Tracy Morgan, Amy Poehler. Yeah, exactly. Amy Poehler, Parks and Rec, yeah.
And movies as well. But you know what's going through my mind is like when Cyrus is saying, talking about SNL being an institution, you know, think about it, man. It's like next year, that show will be 40 years old, man.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it'll be 40 years old. And, you know, I don't know what they're going to do when Lorne Michaels passes away.
Oh, yeah.
If the show's 40 years old, he's got to be in his 60s or 70s.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because look at what happened those couple of years Lorne wasn't there. I mean, that show almost didn't survive without him.
Yeah. Okay. That's weird. Maybe you can fold that in for us, Jared.
Oh, yeah. I've decided I'm going to just live forever. They're going to cut my head off and keep it in a jar like I'm Futurama.
So. Lorne Michaels is here. Where'd he?
He's joining our group.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
John C. Payne joins the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
For a talk about his book series, Three and Out, in this interview.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting interview. Get behind me now. Stay there. Today, we are really pleased to have on from San Antonio, Texas, author John C. Payne. John, welcome so much. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're quite welcome. Happy to participate.
Very, very cool. You have a series of books called Three and Out for all of our listeners out there, and they are just, you know, fantastic stories. And the, you know, you've got the Three and Out, the Chicago, and the Three and Out in the San Francisco, and you know, and Three and Out in San Antonio, Texas. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with the Riverwalk in San Antonio.
Actually, the Three and Out murder in the San Antonio Psych Hospital, which is a subtitle, takes place in a fictional psychiatric hospital about a block off of the Riverwalk. Yes, sir.
And for all of our listeners out there, in San Antonio, Texas is in the United States, and they have a beautiful Riverwalk, which is a lot like the canals in Venice, Italy, and it's very picturesque. So there's a little background for people there. Now let's talk a little bit about, you know, the Three and Out series. You know, how did you get started with that, and where your inspiration come from?
Well, okay. The Three and Out idea came from my past history of moving every 3 years. When I was in the military, I got reassigned every 3 years. After I got out of the military, I moved every 3 years because I got bored. I wanted a new challenge. I wanted a new excitement. And I took on different things that sometimes I regretted it, sometimes I didn't. So the Three and Out idea is moving to a new challenge every 3 years after getting bored with the existing project or situation I was in. So that's the name of my trilogy, but each book has a subtitle. The San Francisco book has to do with managing an apartment complex in downtown San Francisco, and that one is listed as a light humorous about the residents who live in a big urban apartment complex. Conversely, the second book, Ed, in the trilogy, Murder in the San Antonio Psych Hospital, is a deep, deep, deep dark mystery.
Oh,
having to do, well, the powers to be in the CIA felt that there might be Al-Qaeda cells forming downtown near the Riverwalk, so they put a bogus patient in the psych hospital to kind of surveil what's going on, and the next day they find this poor woman in the hospital day room with a gigantic scissors in her chest.
And right. For all of our listening audience around the world, there is your little sample, and if that doesn't draw you in, I don't know what will.
Well, what happened in one of my three-year episodes in the past, I did run a psychiatric hospital, and although I would love to have murdered one of the two or three of the staff members, I had to wait until I wrote a book. So it's a fictional book, but what goes on within the bowels of the psych hospital, real credible thing. So other than the fictional murder.
Right. Almost like a historical novel.
Right. And there's a lot of San Antonio things in there. And that's it. We consider it a regional bestseller because I sell in a bookstore downtown, actually on the Riverwalk. I sell on weekends, I'll sell 22 copies of the book.
Nice.
And then after 3 years, my character moves to Chicago. He was on a cruise out of Galveston when he left the psych hospital. He went on a cruise trying to figure out what in the heck he wanted to do next.
Okay.
And he meets two interesting people. One, an old Army buddy who just inherited a private eye agency in downtown Chicago. So his buddy says, Rod, what are you going to do now? And I said, I have no clue. And his buddy said, why don't you come to Chicago and become a private eye? And Rod said, dang, yeah, I always wanted to be a private eye. And, of course, another person he met on the cruise was a school teacher in the Chicago area. So, boom, Rod goes to Chicago. And lo and behold, he gets involved in two high-profile cases, and the trilogy ends in Chicago. And that's where I was born. So I had to bring it back to my original place of birth, and there's some political kind of things in there. One of the key persons he was hired to surveil by the guy's wife, who thought he was doing things out of school, the individual was a big trucking executive, reputed to be the next Democratic governor of the state of Illinois. And when Rod, my guy, goes out to surveil him, he steps on this, that, and the other.
Okay.
So each book is a different story. It's not part one, two, and three. Just that my guy Rod, he just likes to move on.
So we use the same main character in all three novels. And is Rod going to be moving anywhere in the near future?
I retired Rod. He's getting a little bit too old. I'd, like you and I, maybe can't do some of the things that he did in the past. I have a book right now with Page Publishing in New York. It's a paranormal. It's my first go at a paranormal. And I think it is going to be a big-time one because it involves some pets. It involves three individuals, one guy in France, one in San Francisco, one in Chicago, who have stage 4 melanoma, which means they have 3 or 4 months to live. And they learn of a scientist in South Texas who developed a cure for that. Each individual pays $1 million, flies down to South Texas, gets the serum, I won't tell you how, and
okay.
Lo and behold, when they get back to their respective cities, their melanoma's gone. However,
there is a twist.
When certain environmental conditions take place, they morph into a gigantic size of their vicious pet. One has a python, one has a falcon, one has a French bulldog, and they go out killing with their pets.
Wow.
Until the pets get tired of it and try to stop them.
Oh, I see. Well, then, so has it been published yet, or is it under
review? I just approved the edits. It's moving to a cover, and it'll be out probably in about 2 months. But why I think it's going to be big, Ed, is I have a national pet guy out of California who learned of it. I sent him the manuscript. He read it. He made some recommendations. And his testimonial, and I'll just repeat one of them for your listeners.
Okay.
John Payne's book is a cross between Stephen King's sci-fi fantasy and Michael Crichton's medical business. It should be a top 10 selection in anybody's library. So that's going to be on the cover.
That's quite high praise there.
Well, it is, and that's what I think that will really push this one.
Do you have a title for it?
The title is Stage 4.
Ah, I like it. Stage 4.
I had a different title, and then one or two of my local, we call them beta readers, people who I use to do a first line edit, said, oh, that title you had, John, explains the outcome, and I think you should not lead your readers to the last chapter, so to speak.
Right.
So, Stage 4. Yes, sir.
Well, we'll definitely be looking forward to that. Stage 4 should be coming out in a couple months for all our listeners out there. Now,
Well, I was going to say, during my book signings, I noticed that about everybody from age 15 to about 38 comes in and says, where are the paranormals? I want this, and I'm above doing zombies and vampires and all that. I have a little bit of a medical background, so I wanted to make it a step or two above that.
So now where can people find your books?
All of my books, the three books that are out, they're available on Amazon, both in paperback copy and on Kindle. And I am updating the San Francisco book in the Nook through Barnes & Noble's. It's funny, Ed. I had about 2 weeks of downtime, so I reread my first book, the San Francisco book, and I said, you know what, I can do a lot better. And there were some minor edit errors in there that got through, and a point I'm trying to make to all future listeners of your program who want to write a book is that each book you write or tend to write, you'll get better. You'll learn more. You'll learn what works. And that's what when I went back and read that first book, which came out 4 years ago, and I had to read it. I had to maybe embellish a little bit more, use words that describe a situation better than the words that were printed, clean up some of the edit errors that were missed. And so that one will be coming out in about 2 weeks on Nook in digital form. But on Kindle, through Amazon, the new book, the published book is out. So people can go to those sources, and they could go to my website, www.johncpayne.com. And I have three pages on the website, and the page that has my books will hyperlink into Amazon.
I also noticed on your website that if you go to John C. Payne, and Payne is spelled PAYNE.com, you can also get yourself a signed copy from John himself, and that's fantastic.
That's right. Anybody who wants a signed copy actually has to link back to me and email me that they would like a signed copy.
Okay, hey, you know what? It's very cool, and for all of our listeners out there, we want you to go to johncpayne.com. Order a copy. I would suggest that they order one that's signed, and please know that all your purchases and money will be donated to the Children in San Salvador or the Catholic Church or to John's school in Wisconsin. So with that, you can entertain yourself and do a good turn all at the same time. Of course, John will be the featured author on JustImagineItInc.com. And John, thank you so much for coming on and visiting with us.
I appreciate the call, and my best to all the folks out in your listening area.
To learn more about John C. Payne, visit us on our website at JustImagineInc.com.
kind of girl you are. I only want to see the. I only want to see the kind of girl you are.
After a successful professional career, Jan McInnes now enjoys the spotlight as a stand-up comedian. She talked about the fun she's having with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are very privileged to have on Jan McInnes. She is from Southern California, and she is one of the most hysterical women that you're going to see on the comedy circuit all around the United States.
Oh, thank you so much. And I was thinking maybe I should change my name to Janice because it's more famous Janices than Jan. What do you think?
There you go.
But yeah.
So tell me about, you know, how you got started in comedy. We know you got started when you were 15 years old, so now you've been in it for what now?
I actually had another career before being a comedian. I started out as a marketing person for about 15 years, but I always wanted to be a comedian. You know, I just always wanted to. I wasn't funny or anything in class, but I wasn't the class clown, but I just wanted to be funny. And I remember graduating from college, in fact, and dinner that night, you know, we were all sitting around the restaurant. And I looked around at everybody at the table and I thought, now is not the time to tell them that I want to be a comedian. I just graduated. They just paid for a lot of money here. So I went into marketing for 15 years back in D.C. where I grew up and did that until finally I just decided, you know, I think I can try this. And I did. And it worked. I got hired right off my first open mic to open for Kevin Nealon, who at the time was on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
That was huge. I was very excited and thought, oh, gosh, I'm off to the races. And it took about 2.5 years after I did that first open mic before I really quit my job and went in, on the road into comedy clubs. Because of my job, I had seen the corporate market, though, so I knew there were things other than comedy clubs. Because I was older. I hate to say it, I was not 15 when I started. I wish. I was this is a young person's profession, traveling around and parties all the night and, you know, meeting all these different people and staying up till 3 a.m. every night and all the beer you can possibly drink. It's a great profession if you're young.
Jan, can you sign me up?
You know what? I did all that road stuff in my 30s and it was still hard. You need to be 15 to 28, you know, is a good age to really take advantage of everything. But yeah, the early days are fun. I have to say, you know what? That's the most fun and you're the most broke during them because you're just you're excited about wanting to do your career. A lot of people want to be a comedian or they want to be a writer. They want to be a producer of music or, you know, singer or something. And they don't do it because they think there's some magic pill and they have to wait and they have to get permission. No, that's the problem. You got to just do it. Nobody told me I should be a comedian. I just wanted to do it. So your listeners out there who really want to do it, you've got to take the initiative and do it yourself. I mean, nobody's going to walk in your door and say, hey, I think you're funny. You should get on stage, you know?
Well, yeah, and you know, and what a cool profession. I mean, how many people can actually go around and say, you know what? What do you do for a living? I make people happy. I mean, how cool is that?
Well, it's cool, except living in L.A. is the only city I've noticed where when I say I'm a comedian, you know, they look at me like, okay, what's your real job? I've had friends actually ask, do you really make a living at that? Because here in Los Angeles, everyone is a comedian, but they're really a waitress or bartender or something like that. You know,
right.
They're trying to get their 5 minutes of material or whatever, so they can get their sitcom. But anywhere else in the country, they're impressed. Here, they're just like, oh, yeah, another one of those entertainers that works at a restaurant. It's like, no, really.
Yeah, you know, and you often hear that thing about, you know, comedians, you know, they're so funny, they're so hysterical, but when you meet them in real life, they're sad.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, whenever you hear comedians talking about on stage, it's probably true. If they talk about how broke they are, or how they've lived like a homeless person, they probably did it. So there's a lot of truth in the comedy. They just have found a way to make it, to laugh about it and get other people to laugh about it.
Well, tell me about your blog here.
Well, I have a blog called thecomedywriterblog.com, and it's just tips on writing humor and everything from my experience. It's kind of based on my book. I've got a book, Finding the Funny Fast, how to create quick humor to connect with clients, coworkers, and crowds. And so it's kind of based on tips from that and tips from my own experience. And it's fun. I like it. It gets a lot of attention, so that's nice.
Well, now, aside from the fact that you're not really getting off on staying up till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning drinking beer anymore,
yeah.
What is the fun part for you?
You know what? I love the fun part. I do a lot of mostly corporate shows now. And so I travel around. I learn all about these different industries that I would never have ever known about. Most people get into their career and they stay in one or two different industries their whole life. I've seen 200-300 industries, easy. You know, mushroom growers, alfalfa seed growers, you name it. And it's so it's fun to learn about all these different careers that I never took.
You know, and that sounds fascinating, man. You know, and again, you know, who doesn't want to be entertained, you know?
Right. I and all sorts of industries. I mean, I've done shows for every group. Healthcare is really good. Financial, I mean, I've done programs for the Federal Reserve Banks. I mean, bank examiners may laugh. You know, I've done shows for all sorts of...
They ought to be laughing. They're laughing all the way to the bank. Yeah. No, I think it sounds so cool. I mean, when you travel around the country, I'm assuming that you're not traveling on your scooter.
No, I'm not. Or my motorcycle. I have a motorcycle, too, but I travel on airlines. I used to drive before corporate comedy. I worked comedy clubs for about 10 years or so, and I drove about 50,000 miles a year. So I was all over the country in my little Honda Civic. But now I'm now I fly.
Oh, my gosh. Hey, have you ever heard of a guy named Jack Englehart?
No.
He's an author. Anyway, I go, who'd you hang out with? He goes, I hung out with Bob Dylan, John Lennon, and Lenny Bruce.
Oh,
right?
My gosh.
And I go, and you guys were, he goes, were any of you guys famous then? He goes, John Lennon was famous. Everybody else was not, you know?
Wow, what a crew.
Right. And I go, so what'd you guys talk about? Did you talk about politics, songwriting, and stuff like that? And he goes, no, we just cut jokes all day long.
Lenny Bruce got some material.
Right. Yeah, he was telling me that because he made a comment about George Carlin. He goes, you know how George Carlin gets all the credit for the seven dirty words? He goes, uh-huh. That didn't come from George Carlin. That came from Lenny Bruce.
Oh.
Right?
Interesting.
Right. And so he was telling me about it, and he goes, we were just young guys having the time of our lives. None of us were rich. He goes, even John was famous, but he wasn't rich because the record companies kept the money back then.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, this is about who you hang out with.
Isn't that a crazy story?
That's a great story. I wish I had something to top it. I'm hanging out with my cats. I got nothing.
Well, you're hanging out with me. Oh, come on.
You, with you. I forgot, Edward. Yeah. It's 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon. You're 7, but now it's down to 5, I think. I heard on Facebook. You're 5 people away from who you really want to meet, so... Through you,
yeah.
I'm 5 people away.
Well, now I'm down to 4 because I have met you. Yeah.
I live in L.A. and I don't see that many famous people. I don't recognize them, I guess. I was I used to do extra work when I moved out here. I got on all these different shows, and it was fun. You know, didn't pay much, but it was fun. But I was on this the Charlie's Angels movie, you know, the first one with Lucy Liu and Drew Barrymore and all that.
Oh, man, that must have been a blast.
That was fun. I was an extra on there, but the first day we all got sunburned, so I was sitting in the makeup room, and next to me is Tim Curry, who was it was great. Got a chance to talk to Tim Curry, and you know, he was on the Rocky Horror Picture, and so it was fun. And then I ran into Lou Ferrigno at the airport once, and I saw Richard Simmons running down the airport once in his tight little pink pants. So I think that's all my star sightings out here.
You know what? I think it's changed quite a bit because, you know, back in the day, you know, when I was hanging out and stuff like that, you know, and I was down in L.A. or down in New York and stuff like that, everything was very accessible. There was no 9/11. There was no terrorists running around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was no, let me check your passport. There was none of that stuff was going on, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And you could drive right up and walk right up to the gate and everything. And now, you know, well, now also the stars, I mean, you don't see them at the airport because they have private jets. They don't fly. I love Southwest. They don't fly Southwest. So a friend of mine was next to Garth Brooks on Southwest one time years ago.
All right. Well, tell us, where are you going to be next?
Well, I'm off tomorrow. I'm flying out to Ohio. I co-star with another comedian in the Baby Boomer Comedy Show. We're touring theaters with it, and we've got a theater in Ada, Ohio, of all places. And the next week, I'm in Indiana and El Paso, Texas, and Phoenix. So
that's wow, you get around.
Next 10 days. Yeah. week after that, I'm in Dallas at the AT&T Center, and I'm up in Northern California somewhere. And yeah, so I'm it's getting quite busy.
Well, you know, tell me what. Let's let everybody know where they can find you on the web, because I think this internet thing. I think this internet thing is going to catch on, Jan.
I think so too. You can check out my website, www.theworklady.com, because I do a lot of office humor. Theworklady.com.
Okay. Did you come up with that on your own?
I did, because nobody can spell McGinnis, so I had to come up with something else. So that's what I came up with.
Theworklady.com, which is formerly theworkman.com.
Don't call it the working lady. That's a totally different profession.
Oh, okay. I got to admit, man, I still love that line. Girls, this is what happens when you don't marry rich.
Good. Well, I'm glad you like that. You're very flattering.
Okay, so then you also have a blog.
I do have the blog, comedywriterblog.com.
Well, you're on YouTube, you're on Facebook, you're everywhere.
Facebook, LinkedIn, I've got a, go to janfans.com, that's my Facebook fan page. JanFans, but with an S, fans.com.
Beautiful. And I'm telling you, man, it was such a blast talking with you.
Oh, it was really nice talking with you, Edward. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
To learn more about Jan McGinnis, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
You got your H.P. Lovecraft, your Edgar Allan Poe. You got your own kind of ravens and your murderer crows. Catty eyelashes and your Dracula cape. Been flashing AAA passes at the cemetery gates, cause you're so dark.
Summer House with Swimming Pool, a New York Times bestseller. When a medical procedure goes horribly wrong and famous actor Ralph Meyer winds up dead, Dr. Mark Schlosser needs to come up with some answers. After all, reputation is everything in this business. Personally, he's not exactly upset that Ralph is gone, but as a high-profile doctor to the stars, Mark can't hide from the truth forever. It all started the previous summer. Mark, his wife, and their two beautiful teenage daughters agreed to spend a week at the Meyers' extravagant summer home on the Mediterranean. Joined by Ralph and his striking wife Judith, her mother, and film director Stanley Forbes and his much younger girlfriend, the large group settles in for days of sunshine, wine tasting, and trips to the beach. But when a violent incident disrupts the idyll, darker motivations are revealed, and suddenly no one can be trusted. As the ultimate holiday soon turns into a nightmare, the circumstances surrounding Ralph's later death begin to reveal the disturbing reality behind that summer's tragedy. Featuring the razor-sharp humor and acute psychological insight that made The Dinner an international phenomenon, Summer House with Swimming Pool is a controversial, thought-provoking novel that showcases Herman Koch at his finest.
Judith Meyer was sitting across from me at my desk. I looked at her face. The red blotches were still there. It was hard to tell, in fact, whether her face was white with red blotches or red with white.
"You're finished," she said again. Then she went on. "This whole flea circus is going to shut down so fast, it will make your head spin."
She nodded toward my office door with the full waiting room behind. I put my elbows on the desk, then, forming a tent with my fingertips, I leaned forward slightly. "Judith," I said. But suddenly I didn't know how to go on. "Judith," I tried then. "Isn't it a bit early to draw such drastic conclusions? Maybe I did diagnose Ralph's illness incorrectly at first. I've admitted that possibility already, and that will come up tomorrow at the hearing. But I never intentionally. Why don't you just save it and see how the Board of Medical Examiners reacts when I tell them the whole story myself?" I stared at her. I tried to smile, but my mouth felt the way it had the time I broke my jaw in a cycling accident. A pothole. Men at work. A little barrier had been set up to alert oncoming cyclists to the hole in the road, but some joker had removed it. At the emergency room, they wired my upper and lower jaws together. For 6 weeks I could neither talk nor consume anything but liquids through a straw. "Are you going to be there too?" I asked as calmly as I could. "That's not exactly custom." "Yes, that's what they told me. But they thought the charges were serious enough to make an exception." This time I really did smile. Or at least I succeeded in twisting my mouth into something that could be said to resemble a smile. But it felt as though I was opening my mouth for the first time after remaining silent for a whole day. "Wait. Let me check with my assistant for a moment," I said, rising from my chair. "I'll get together all the test results in the files." Now Judith started to her feet, too. "Don't bother. I've said everything I have to say. I'll see you tomorrow at the hearing."
A deliciously Mr. Ripley-esque drama, says O, the Oprah magazine. Herman Koch is the author of several novels and three collections of short stories. The Dinner has been published in 25 countries and has been the winner of a major award in 2009. He currently lives in Amsterdam. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com. Get Behind Me, Now Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
Can't breathe.